Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to harness curiosity in search of truth, which means I get to talk about anything I want. Today, I am delighted to have with me a woman who's going to provide us with some most intriguing conversation. She is Melina White, founder of the Seattle Conservative. In addition to politics, Melina writes about culture and LGBTQ style as a contributor to Dapper Q, the popular queer style community. Melina, thank you for joining me on Real Talk. Welcome.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for having me on today.
It's a delight. I noticed on the Seattle Conservative that you bill yourself as a right-of-center libertarian person of culture. Color. Let me say that again. A right-of-center libertarian person of color. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of people question why I decided to name my website the Seattle Conservative and why I describe myself in that way. And to be frank, at first it was to be a little bit provocative because of Seattle and, you know, Western Washington being in many ways kind of a cultural bubble. And I, being a person who grew up in the South and then from the East Coast, I think I just have a little bit of a different perspective of all political viewpoints. And I think that we have a lot more in common than we have different as people. And so I wanted to kind of, in a way, intrigue people with that name and intrigue people by describing myself as a conservative to want to have more conversation and understand why. So I would say really I would describe myself more as a libertarian, and I would say that even more so in the last 4 years since the last presidential election. I think many of the values that I assign to being a conservative have been lost by the people who describe themselves as conservative leaders in our country. But for me, what it means to be, you know, right-of-center libertarian is, first off, I believe very strongly in individual rights, civil rights, social rights, and social justice. But at the same time, I think at a government level, it's very important that we have laws in place that protect citizens fiscally, and that we're using tax dollars when necessary and having transparency around that, that we're not instituting laws and regulations that violate individuals' rights. And so that's really where that right of center comes in for me, is being fiscally responsible and not having overreaching government, whether it's at a federal level or right in our towns here in Western Washington.
Could you give us some examples of laws that you think are restricting civil rights here, either in Washington or federally?
Oh, sure. I could give you lots of examples. And again, that's what I think is kind of almost upside down right now in our country, is that I see it from people who espouse themselves as conservatives, but also then people who would describe themselves as more liberal or even like as democratic socialists. But here in Seattle, I think we've instituted a lot of laws and taxes that in many ways do violate individual rights. But not just that, maybe they don't even help to solve the problems that they're hoping to solve. So, you know, I live here in Seattle, and just to throw out a couple of ideas, for instance, the law to ban plastic straws, right? Mm-hmm. Now, as an individual, I am not a fan of plastic straws. I personally own reusable straws, and I encourage, you know, my friends to do the same. And I think that there were already a lot of businesses here in Seattle that said, hey, you know, we want to do the right thing, and we want to have more, you know, sustainable packaging at our restaurant. But by instituting a law saying, hey, we're banning these straws, not only did it take away the power from small businesses to be able to make decisions to serve their consumers, but also, you know, be profitable, it also had the opposite effect, where some companies said, well, if we can't use plastic straws anymore, we're going to come up with new packaging that still uses a lot of plastic. In fact, we have to use more plastic to have the straw. But hey, we're now abiding by this new law that says no plastic straws. So we didn't really solve the problem of reducing the use of plastic or non-recyclable plastic. but we did up pricing on packaging. And more importantly, we tied the hands of the smaller businesses that it's more difficult for them to respond. You know, a company like Starbucks, easy for them to respond. And again, Starbucks is now using more plastic in their cups because we don't have straws. So we didn't really solve any problems, but now we have more and more layers of regulation. And then the cost to taxpayers to enforce those laws, to make sure that all these restaurants aren't using plastic straws, is another element.
Are they being enforced? Are there straw police going from coffee shop or from pub to pub?
I would imagine right now there's probably no straw police. We're all focused on much bigger things at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you bring up a point that is near and dear to my heart, and that is that when it comes to laws about the climate crisis and about civil justice, we tend to create Band-Aid laws without doing cradle-to-cradle studies of how each of those things is going to truly impact either the environment or civil justice. How would you respond to that notion?
Well, I agree completely. I mean, you know, right now we're in the midst of these wildfires that are happening all along the West Coast. And mm-hmm. you know, right now in Western Washington, especially where I am, I think we're still under a hazardous level of smoke. So the results of this crisis is front and center. And, you know, oftentimes I say that we're always arguing about the wrong things, because when I'm watching the news and I'm hearing what the president has to say about the wildfires, and then I'm hearing what, you know, the governor of California and Oregon have to say about the wildfires, you could argue that they all have a point, but we're still not really focusing on solutions. There's absolutely, there's plenty of evidence to prove that climate change has a lot to do with why these fires are occurring. But we also have a lot of evidence to show that it's been decades of mismanagement at a federal level of, you know, preventing natural fires from happening in our national lands for decades that are making these wildfires worse and worse and worse every year. And so just by focusing on one argument and just saying, hey, climate change and we've got to reduce emissions, that's not going to help us to really come up with a solution to prevent these wildfires from occurring, and not only occurring, but getting worse every single year, mm-hmm. but also just focusing on, well, hey, we don't know if climate change is really a thing, or we don't know if it's man-made. That also is not helping either. But it's really, I see everybody is just kind of like digging in their heels. They have one perspective on why a problem is happening, and they're unwilling to have like that conversation and that dialogue to come to a compromise and find different facets of solutions to problems and look at the nuance. And I think these wildfires is a perfect example, because there's a lot of elements and there's a lot of things that have happened that have led to this point on the West Coast that is really kind of completely out of control now. It's going to be very hard to reverse for decades to come.
It is apparently completely out of control. And it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is a logical, comprehensive look at issues like wildfires and the impact of climate crisis and years of denial, neglect, procrastination,
mm-hmm.
that people have not been willing to tackle. The federal government particularly has not been willing to tackle the management of their forests. And I suppose all those fires will stop when we run out of trees. But until then, we need to think about how to manage those things. And the idea that you're posing is one of, it sounds to me, a logical look at all the issues without the politics that get involved. How possible
exactly
do you think that is in our current culture?
I have to say I'm not very optimistic. I think that as a society, we're just so polarized right now. And it's so hard, depending on what side you're on, for you to even listen and hear the other side. And everything's become political. I don't think the management of our forest should be so political, but it is now. Mm-hmm. And really everything down to, you know, whether or not you're going to wear a mask in public has become political, or it says something about your ideology, and it shouldn't. We should be able to have conversations. We should be able to really go to the experts in fields. So, you know, when it comes to wearing a mask, science, you know, those in medical science, when it comes to the wildfires, really talking to organizations that have experience in both climate science, but also in forest management and finding solutions. And at this point, I think that we have to get a little bit more radical in finding solutions to these wildfires, or again, we're just going to have decades more of this issue that will get worse with each passing year.
And what would you consider radical?
Well, here's one. I'm going to throw this out.
Great.
Here's one idea I have. Okay. Because here on, you know, in the western part of the United States, we have the great majority of federally held land. And I know, again, from like a political perspective, there's a lot of talk about how it's so critical that we preserve federal land and we don't give it out to the states. We certainly don't hand it over to private entities. But with these fires, I think we've proven that our federal government is either unable or unwilling to properly manage this land, which has led to these wildfires. Vast majority of where it's happening is on either federal or private land, not state-run land. So what if, radical idea, we go to, we partner with, in some capacity, with private organizations. We partner with, you know, leaders in technology. I mean, not only is the West Coast known for wildfires, but we're also known for the world's technology leaders. I mean, go to Jeff Bezos, go to the CEOs of Microsoft, of Apple, and say, hey, you have the resources, you have the connections to find the best scientists and the infrastructure to execute solutions. Can we come up with a partnership of not necessarily handing off this federal land to you, but finding a partnership and how you can help us to clear out these forests, clear out this years and years of buildup that's causing the heat and the fire to occur, that we can come up with solutions? Because it's going to be good for everybody. You know, if the West Coast is going to continue to be a desirable place for enterprises to build their businesses, for people to want to come here and live and have careers, then we can't have these crazy wildfires every year. So partnering in a real way with private business, private and government business together to come up with solutions, I think could be a great way to approach it. Because our federal government, again, we aren't as nimble, we aren't as innovative, we just don't have the resources, the tools, or the money to be able to attack these issues in a way that it needs to be done immediately. It would take, you know, a decade to build the infrastructure just to come up with a solution of what we need today.
So, Melina, that doesn't sound like a bad idea. You're talking about harnessing a public-private partnership that would have as its mission the best interests of the good of the whole, if you will.
Right.
To what other issues might you apply that sort of thing? Like, is there any way to apply that to our current social unrest regarding black and brown people, social justice? Do you see a public-private partnership serving the best interests of our, what we now call our minority populations, who aren't going to be minority for very long?
You know, that's a really good question, because I've had so much time to really think about how the private sector and also how government has responded to the latest protests and civil unrest in our country. And, you know, as you said in the introduction, I am a person of color. I am multiracial. I am a lesbian, so I'm like, I like to joke that I am a minority poster child. So these are issues that certainly impact me and my family personally. And I don't know, for me, I question the response from both the private and the public sector, and I don't know if them partnering together would make it even better. I see a lot of private businesses that are making very grand statements about how they're listening, how Black Lives Matter, how they're going to make changes. But I don't see any tangible evidence of action that's going to truly be good for our community. And then also at a government level, again, if you look at the city of Seattle and the way we've handled it, if I had to describe myself as a one-issue voter, it would absolutely be criminal justice reform. I think it is one of the biggest issues in our country, both locally and nationally, and it's probably the way our criminal justice system is applied creates the most inequality in our country. However, seeing how swiftly our city went straight to defunding the police department, pushing out our chief, Carmen Best, without a real plan, without doing the work to study and understand the systemic issues that we're facing in our city, I didn't see that as a solution either. I think, if anything, it's just making things worse. And so a private-public partnership, you know, I feel like both need to do a lot more homework
to understand the
underlying issues before we can come up with solutions.
Well, and I think the situation you just described in Seattle regarding the police and Carmen Best kind of illustrates that quick to action without thinking it through process that it does end up causing perhaps more problems than it solves. You, in your letter to KUOW, you, and that was the first time I'd heard of you, you address your liberal white friends directly about what you say is sort of pseudo-activism, if that's my term, regarding Black Lives Matter. There are a lot of folks like that here on Vashon Island. In fact, there is a Vashon Island chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice. I don't know if you're familiar with Surge. But there's an active chapter here that a lot of them focus on criminal justice reform. And I'll have to, full disclosure, I'm a member of that group. What would you say to us about pseudo-activism for criminal justice and Black Lives Matter as opposed to real activism? What can we do?
Well, I think, and that's something that I touched on in my essay, I think the first thing, the most important thing, and that's with solving any kind of social or human issue, is really understanding and knowing people as individuals. And one of the things that is really striking to me living here in Seattle, and I've been here for 14 years now, but I am from Miami and I was born in kind of a minority inner city part of Miami. So very, very stark difference between where I grew up and here in Seattle. And I started to notice a trend, especially in the last few years, of people who, you know, I might follow on social media, maybe their acquaintances, coworkers, but folks who are really, really vocal about the Black experience and discrimination against Black people and minorities and people in the LGBTQ community. But then I started also noticing that they never posted a picture of them, like, hanging out with a Black friend. They never posted a picture of themselves being involved or engaging in a minority community activity. They were almost tokenizing people of color to, in a way, create a platform for themselves of, hey, I read this book, I went to this class, therefore now I'm an authority and I understand what the experience is. And I think that you will never really be able to understand that unless you have personal relationships with people who are different than you. So I know it's hard because Seattle is, or, you know, Western Washington is a pretty white part of the country.
Yeah.
But with a little bit of effort, you can make friends with people who are different from you. And I'm not just talking about, you know, race or sexual orientation. I'm talking about people who just have a different life experience. Maybe they lived in a different socioeconomic space than you, a different part of the country, different culture, and really understanding their life experience And when you start there, then you can better understand what they need from you to help with a movement or to help their causes move forward. Because I often see things that folks here in Seattle have been trying to push, quote unquote, on my behalf, and it's not what I want. I mean, I would say that defunding the police is a perfect example. If you look at polls of majority black communities and black cities across the country and ask them if they wanted to fund their police departments, they'll look at you like you're crazy. No, they don't want to fund the police. Obviously, there are reforms that need to happen in our criminal justice system, but it doesn't necessarily mean that less police are, you know, in the community. And I think right there, that's a great example of the lack of understanding. Because when you grow up in a middle class or upper middle class suburban community where the need for police is not as urgent as in other parts of the country where maybe you're growing up in the inner city, then the idea of just defunding the police sounds great. Sure. And that will help black people, right? Because they're getting shot by police all the time. But in reality, that's not the case. In reality, most black Americans don't want to defund their police departments. So I think that's just a perfect example of how when you actually have a conversation and you have a relationship with a person of color, you can better understand how you can help.
So it's a whole lot easier to make sweeping extreme generalizations than it is to actually get to know people of color, people from different lifestyles. And of course, not all people of color have had the same life experience as
that
well.
Too. Yeah, and I think that's a really, really important element as well to understand is that, sure, I may have faced some, I don't know if I would want to use the word oppression, but I've challenges that probably you, Susan, haven't faced in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that you've also faced challenges in your life that I haven't. And it's just generalizing that all Hispanics or all blacks have this same experience or have the same perspective is quite ignorant. And I think that's another thing that can sometimes be frustrating living in the bubble of Seattle, Western Washington,
mm-hmm.
is how everyone looks at me as if I have this perspective because of the color of my skin, which is why they're always shocked when they hear about my website called the Seattle Conservative.
Well, and that was...
But you'd be surprised. There's a lot of us.
Well, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you is that because you describe yourself as a minority poster child, what are some of the assumptions you think people make about you when they first meet you? And what's the truth about that?
Good question. Well, first off, they assume that I have certain political perspectives for sure. I think it's funny how people will just, say things to me like, oh, yeah, don't like that guy. Or could you believe that law was passed? And I want to just say, well, yeah, I voted for it. I think people definitely feel that I have a certain perspective about politics. I think people believe that I have a certain perspective about just societal norms, the kind of language we should use, how we should interact with each other. I've even had people have stereotypes about what kind of music I listen to or, what kind of entertainment I prefer just by looking at me, just in a chance meeting with me. So, yeah, I think a lot of people make assumptions based on appearances.
And I think that's kind of the American way. We like to categorize people so we feel safe and we can know what to expect, by things like race, gender, sexual preference, astrological sign, whatever. You've been here in Seattle for 14 years. You've been writing the Seattle Conservative for, 3 or 4 years?
About 4 years. It was not long after the 2016 election.
Is that what prompted you, or what did prompt you to start writing that?
Immediately saw a problem with our system shifting, and it's really at peak right now. There's such lack of civility. immediately here in Seattle. You know, I certainly was disappointed and surprised with the election, but also it's like, okay, so this is where we are. We still want to, you know, make we can. You know, we have to work with what we have. But I immediately saw people just digging their heels in and saying, like, I think I saw one thing on social media that, frankly, I just thought was humorous. It said, your vote was a hate crime to all the to the Trump voters. And I was like, yeah, that's a little extreme. So I wanted to have a platform to kind of have conversations about the nuance and the common ground that both sides have, and also create a platform for the libertarian voice, because there's not as many platforms for us out there. And I think that we often have perspectives. But it definitely came out of just the extreme polarization that I saw in our country post the 2016 election.
And you moved here from Florida 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't remember what it was like now, but what was it that surprised you when you moved from Florida to Seattle? What about Seattle was surprising?
Wow. Well, it's almost like living in a different country. Because not only am I from Florida, but I'm from Miami. And Miami is, you know, such a culturally diverse place. More than half of the people, the residents of Miami, are immigrants. We're born outside the United States and from all over South America, Caribbean, Europe. So I definitely saw a homogeny in Seattle that I wasn't used to. I was used to a lot more cultural diversity, everything from food to music to language. So that was something that was certainly different that I needed to get used to. But there was also something wonderful about Northwest culture that attracted me here that I still love and appreciate. And also, I really learned more about, frankly, the United States and our history of people migrating to the western part of this country that I didn't really have an understanding of growing up on the East Coast and growing up in a more or less like Latin Caribbean culture. So it was in every way, the way people interact with each other. You know, we have a reputation of being very passive aggressive here in South Florida. People could not be more direct in how they feel. Complete strangers, doesn't matter. People are just a lot more direct, a lot more aggressive. So I certainly had to not only just lower my general conversational voice, but also kind of tamper down a little bit and how I interacted with people to fit and assimilate with the Northwest culture a little bit better.
But I moved here.
I've been here for 40 years, though.
I moved here from Chicago and had a similar issue. I had to tamp down my directness and get used to the Seattle chill, if you will.
Yes. There's definitely the Seattle freeze. Yeah, I had never been told that Seattle I was loud so many times. I was like, I'm the quiet one in my family. What are you talking about?
I know the feeling. I relate. Melina White, I am afraid we have run out of time. In your letter to KUOW, you said you wanted us white liberals to invite you out for a cocktail. So here on the air on Voice of Vashon, I am inviting you to come to Vashon, and I would be happy to buy you a cocktail as soon as we can sit outside again. Will you come to Vashon? That would be great.
Yes.
I want to thank you for joining us, and thank you, folks, for listening. Take care, Melina.
You too.